Hi, y'all. We are back for another episode, and this is a highly requested topic. Today, I am so excited. We are going to talk about sleep with autistic children. We know that there is a lot of times this is disrupted. And why I'm particularly excited today is I have a board certified sleep medicine physician who specializes in pediatric sleep with us on the podcast today. Welcome to a parenting space actually designed for you, where you can get answers about navigating a life that includes autism. I'm Dr. Tay, a licensed child psychologist and parental coach specializing in neurodivergent affirming care. I have supported hundreds of autistic children and their families and have been in the autism field for over a decade. And I know firsthand the impact autism can have. I was 12 years old when my little brother was diagnosed and my family had to learn how to navigate the autism journey. It wasn't always easy. 2 decades later, I now create resources and services I wish my family had, including this podcast, and I developed the whole family approach. On this podcast, of course, we will talk about autism, but we will also talk about your personal growth and well-being as a parent, supporting your non-autistic children, and sharing personal stories of other families so you know you're not alone. Quick disclaimer before we jump into today's episode. Anything shared on this podcast should not be considered clinical advice, and you should consult with your team of medical, mental health, and developmental providers if you need support. So I am really eager to be able to pick her brain. So Dr. Funky Afolabi Brown here on the podcast today. She is Restful Sleep MD on Instagram, and that is how we connected. But I am so excited to have you here today. Welcome to this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes, I'm just so thrilled. I'm just a fan of your work. I think it's phenomenal.
Thank you. Thank you. That means so much. So give us a little background. I obviously did an intro, but talk a little bit about being a sleep medicine physician and how you even got into this field. I'm really curious of the backstory.
Yeah. So I'll do the short version because there can't all kinds of versions.
Yeah.
But to become a sleep medicine physician, it means you've of course gone through medical school, you've become a doctor, you've done your residency, which is that initial training. And then you have also done an additional training in maybe internal medicine or pediatrics or whatever. And then you now do what we call a fellowship. So that's really how you get in there. So we have people from different tracks going into sleep medicine. Pediatrics is a very, very excruciatingly smaller field. I think there's like maybe about 300 pediatric sleep medicine physicians. So meaning that we did pediatric residency. And then I did another fellowship in pulmonary medicine. And then I went ahead and did my training. Yeah.
Wow. I don't think I realized that there wasn't like a direct residency path for sleep medicine, that it's really specialized. This is also putting into context, though, why it's so hard to find sleep medicine doctors. And then they often have very long wait lists because there's just not a lot of you guys doing this work.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. We need more people doing it, but you're spending a lot of time training.
A lot. Yeah, absolutely. What does it mean exactly to be a sleep medicine physician? What are the type of, obviously sleep is in the name, but peel back the layers a little bit for parents of what this truly means and what you can help with.
No, I think that's an excellent question, honestly, because many people are not aware that there's a doctor for sleep. Like sleep is just what we do. And it's never much of an issue until you have a hard time or you have a loved one that has a hard time getting it, right? So my focus is optimizing sleep health. But typically a sleep medicine physician will do a wide variety take care of a wide variety of sleep disorders. So anywhere from my child is snoring or my child has restless sleep or my child is unable to sleep. And so really we're dealing with the whole gamut. And to make people understand it, I usually use 3 different categories. So we have the medical sleep issues, which are the things most people are aware of. Oh yeah, restless leg syndrome, sleep apnea, right? There's all of that. There are quite a few other sleep disorders within that category. And then the next category, if you will, are the behavioral sleep issues. So these are those kids who may have tantrums at bedtime or the cold sleeping or habits where they're stuck with their iPad in their room and they want the TV on, all those, or they drink caffeine. So that's a second category. And then the third is more of, for me, what I use, how I describe this to parents is, what are those? There's some 24-hour factors that are there when you're going to sleep. So if you have anxiety, guess what? Anxiety doesn't go away. If you have autism, it's going to manifest in its own unique way at bedtime, right? Or ADHD or depression or things like that. So I have to figure out where your child fits in. And sometimes you have a child, i.e. a lot of kids with autism, that might be in all those three buckets.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's super helpful. So let's actually run with this, the three buckets, because I'm interested to talk about each of these factors. Of the first one that comes to mind is, like, for autistic kids, are yes. there certain medical conditions that you see co-occurring that impact sleep more often for autistic kids?
In terms of medical, I would say yes. So we have seen, especially if they have either autism with or without ADHD, actually, a higher prevalence one of insomnia. So that's one. And also disorders like restless leg syndrome or restless sleep overall. That's another one. And there's some studies that show that some of these kids may actually be at a higher risk for sleep apnea. But I think a lot of times when they do those kind of studies, they're selected samples. So I don't know if that's a true reflection when it comes to sleep apnea. But those are the ones I would say for sure seem to be more common. And then in some situations, now we're seeing that it's the kind of research is still emerging. It's still a little bit young to show that some of these kids actually have what we call circadian rhythm issues, meaning that it's almost like their rhythms are delayed. Their internal clock is a little more delayed. So you may not be able to get them to fall asleep at when your typically developing child, for instance, would fall asleep.
Okay. What do you do about that? If you are suspecting that their circadian rhythm is either offset or just is completely disrupted.
Yeah. So different strategies. Honestly, it's not one thing. It's a combination. And the reason why that came up really is we're seeing also, this is a little bit older research now, where they're showing that children with autism might have either a delay or a lower production of the sleep hormone melatonin. So melatonin we call it the hormone of darkness. It prepares our brain for sleep. And in children with autism, it's been shown that it's a combination of lower production / later production. And so because of that, many times we may need to use our melatonin in some situations. And then we combine that with all kinds of what we call behavioral strategies. So making sure that we're very structured and very scheduled, making sure that we're using other kind of external cues to train their internal clocks.
Yeah. What are some of those? Talking in this behavioral bucket, some of the things that you're often talking with parents of autistic kids about to be able to implement.
Yeah. It all depends on the situation. If you have a child, for instance, who has a hard time winding down, first, I want to get a sense of what does that even mean, right? So some might be, there may just be too much sensory input at bedtime. In that case, we're really focusing on what does that routine look like? How do we make sure it is as calm and less sensory stimulating as possible? So that's a big one. The other things that I see also are just in terms of the order of the routines, right? Those are also some strategies that we put in place. What are the things that your child hates the most? We're going to make sure that's the beginning of the routine in that sense. Like, your child goes berserk every time you're brushing their teeth. You don't want to make that the last part of the routine because then it's going to be hard for them to wind down. And then the other piece is light. Like, what does their light exposure look like? Are we trying to make sure that we're making things dimmer, like in the evening, because all that will do is, again, start to prime their brains for sleep. And then is it a child that does require a lot of device time? In which case, funny enough, in children with autism, I don't recommend taking away the device all the time, right? For some, where I see that it is absolutely impacting their sleep, maybe we can modify strategies, but are there ways we can use it to our advantage? Are there shows we could put in that will help bring that, take them down a few notches, but still, and also help them to relax. So we can use device to our advantage, but in that way too, we're making sure that there is some time between when they're using the device and when they're falling asleep. Another piece of it is, how are they falling asleep? Is there codependence at bedtime? Do they need a person there for them to fall asleep? In which case, then we're creating a plan to either get the parent out of the room so that the child can learn independent sleep. That is not always successful. I think it also takes a lot of engagement and really motivation on the parent side as well. And then in the morning, right? The other piece we talked about is what's happening when they wake, if they wake up in the middle of the night. So yeah. What are the responses? There's a whole host of things there, right? Sometimes we're just like, you know what? Whatever gets everybody else to sleep. But in some situations, their nighttime wakings may be because of the way they've fallen asleep. So we go back to the beginning of the night to say, rubbing to fall asleep, in which case they have that sleep association where they remember the last time they were asleep, someone was rubbing their back. So we got to get your hand off their back for them to learn to fall asleep on their own so that when they wake up in the middle of the night, they can learn those skills to fall back asleep. Mm. And then at the end of the morning, then we talk about how are they waking up? What's light exposure like? How does that look, right? Because really, I usually recommend your child waking up to light as much as possible, because again, that helps with that regulation of their internal clock, especially for some of the kids that seem like they're a little bit shifting. Then one other one, and I'm just throwing a lot here. So it's almost like a menu of options, but you're going to have to figure out where you are, where your child is, to be able to tailor to specific interventions. We do what we call bedtime fading very often for those kids who maybe they're in bed, but you notice they're just tossing and turning for almost an hour or more after you've said goodnight to them, in which case, or you're noticing that they're having a hard time falling asleep and everybody's riled up and stressed out about it, in which case we delay their bedtime. Because what we then try to do is we match the time we put them in bed to align with the chance of them falling asleep. Mm. And then over time, as their sleep onset starts to shorten, then we do what we call sleep extension, where we now start to get them to bed earlier gradually. So there's quite a few behavioral strategies I think we can use. And we're doing that and constantly thinking, are there medical issues going on? Are there other medical comorbidities? Because we want to handle that. Some of these kids might have reflux, and a lot of times that goes undiagnosed for so long. Mm. If they have things like epilepsy or seizures or things like that, sometimes that can disrupt their sleep. If they have restless leg syndrome, and it's really hard, especially if you have a child that's nonverbal, to elicit. So really cluing in to make sure that we're not missing any medical components as we go through these strategies.
Yeah. Wow. There is so much there. And so I have so many follow-up questions. So where to start? Let's go back to some of these like behavioral strategies. One thing sometimes, like you were talking about, like the co-regulation or co-dependency to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. How do you usually navigate parents balancing their own sleep needs, their own dysregulation, and sometimes the means to the end of, okay, I'll do this because I know they'll finally sleep and so will the rest of us. How do you, often balance all of that? That's something when I'm talking about sleep can be, it's a tricky balance, right? Because sleep is so important for mental health and regulation and all of that.
And I think it's both, right? Because when you think about some of the things that parents who have children with autism have to go through, it is hard, right? But then I think it's looking at it both ways and saying, we need you to do, or would your child would benefit from this, that, and the other strategies. But if they're exhausted and they're so sleep deprived and they're anxious and depressed, then it's going to be hard for them to show up and to show up consistently to follow through with that plan. And for some of these, you know, one of the things I always say is it'll get hard a little bit harder before it gets easier, because these are new behaviors. Your child is like, what is the world is going on? We had this whole co-sleeping thing going. Life was good. What are you saying now? So it's really knowing that within the first couple of days or weeks, it might be actually really hard. Nobody might get sleep. But then we're looking at what's the long-term gain that we have to benefit from that. And I think for every child, like, it's so varied in terms of how do we get them to cooperate or do certain things that we want them to do that will be beneficial for them. And one other piece that I often goes often gets forgotten is a lot of times these kids are seeing other therapists. They may be seeing they may have ABA, they may have other resources, PT, OT, that they're working with. So sometimes we kind of create this whole novel plan based on the unique ways by which they either communicate or get them to do stuff. And so we're sort of extrapolating that into their bedtime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. And I think for me, I also think about parents checking in with themselves and their own capacity as well, right? It's probably not the time to make all of these changes if you're like under a deadline at work, right?
Yes.
Because your stress is already high and you're trying to change too much at once. Similarly, sometimes I'll talk with parents about what are the most important priorities right now across all therapies, right? Every therapist is always, this is the most important, but sometimes we have to table some things and it's a not right now, but knowing we can circle back, right? We can't change everything at once.
Oh.
And so piecemealing it and over time accumulating. So I find that to be helpful for parents to actually check in on and deciding when is the right time, because you're right. It does get a little harder sometimes before it gets better.
Can I just say, I love that so much. And that's the thing I always tell parents, because what we're asking you to do is a little bit of change in behavior, and it's hard. And I tell folks, I'm like, you know what? If you're not ready, that's okay, right? And I think that just brings that sense of relief, because sometimes they feel that, oh, I failed my child because I couldn't. And it's not the case. It's what do you all need at this point? If you have a child who is really flailing and falling apart, and we say, okay, oh my gosh, it's all because he's not getting a wink of sleep, then we're going to say, okay, maybe that kind of moves up in the priority list
absolutely.
A little bit.
Yeah. Because if the kid's not sleeping, you're not sleeping either.
You're not sleeping. And safety, everything depends on that. So I really love that. Checking in with what am I able to handle at this point before then moving on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then my next question, and this is something that I have been hearing. So when you DM'd me and were like, what do you think about me coming onto the podcast? I was like, yes, please. Because I've been hearing this a lot of these nighttime awakenings where parents literally describe like their kid is so awake, they're ready to start the day, 4 a.m., 2 a.m. wakings. And obviously that's disrupting their sleep cycle. What are some like key things you recommend starting to look at to be able to support that ability to fall back asleep?
Back asleep. Yeah, that's a very common one actually with children with autism. And I think the thing also is a lot of the studies that I've looked at, oh, this is the amount of sleep this child should get, or I don't know, an 8-year-old should get. Those are normative means. Like those are not the normal in the sense of typically developing children. So honestly, what's the sleep need of a child that has autism? Sometimes I tell folks, like, it may not necessarily be that your child needs 12 hours of sleep. Maybe they need 10, maybe they need 11. We don't know. We don't have that research to be able to see. So I think a couple of things is still going back to what is going on, to how they are falling asleep.
Mm-hmm.
We always keep checking in, because sometimes we have that them being able to fall asleep. We have it all down pat. And then over time, things just start to slide. Maybe there's just too much activation and things like that. And that just feeds in and contributes to disrupted sleep. And then also, are they falling asleep independently, or is there a parent that needs to be there? So we go back to that, because that's, I feel like of all the periods of sleep onset during the night and waking up, that sleep onset is usually what we can control a little bit. By the middle of the night, everybody's exhausted and it's really hard to try to do anything. So we try to focus and just really make sure that is, we have that down pat. Again, we're ruling out no medical issue. Now they're just waking up. And then the question is, what are they doing? Are they disrupted? Are they moving around? Is there like a safety issue? In which case, usually what I recommend is, especially if the child has a chance of running down the steps, that we put like baby gates in place, because that safety piece is really important. And then these are the situations, again, we're going back to those three pillars. Like, where can we modify? What are the responses? What's the response of the parent, right? Are they feeding in? Are they meeting? Is the child asking for, I don't know, a burger in the middle of the night? And we're like, here, just take. So we're really trying to make sure that response is consistent. In some situations, when you get to a point where you've ruled out every single behavioral issue that is possible, and there's a whole gamut of that, and you've ruled out, like, there's no medical issue, it's not periodically movements, it's not sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, we've ruled all that out. In some situations, some kids do need medication. So that may be where we start to say, okay, maybe this is where we need to either start melatonin if they've not been on melatonin before, or start some other medication or the other just to help give the families the respite. I usually will use that especially for kids who are really disruptive and just really have a hard time starting to struggle even with daytime function, or kids who their parents are also now at the point where they're struggling. So that's really where we start to go and start. Those are the kind of conversations we start having.
Yeah. So with medication and like supplements or that kind of realm, what are common things? You've ruled out some of the underlying medical causes and working through some of the behavioral pieces, but what are common medications that you're often talking with families about, or options there?
Real quick, just a brief interruption, because I want you to know you don't have to navigate this journey alone. If you're in a place where you have concerns about your child's development, you've been on the search for a therapist that provides evidence-informed neurodivergent affirming care, or you're needing more support as a parent, the whole family approach may be a good fit for you. Autism doesn't just impact your child's life, so you deserve care that works for your child and your whole family. Head to the link in the show notes to schedule a complimentary call where we can chat about your unique circumstances. We can help you decide if Dr. Tay Concierge Clinical Care would be a good fit for your family. And if not, we will provide you resources for your next best steps.
Yeah, the options are not a wide array. I would say for sure, especially because of how much, although it's still limited, the research is, I usually typically, personally, depending on what's going on, usually we'll start with melatonin. Many of these kids may have started melatonin anyway, right?
By the time they get to you, are a lot of these kids already on melatonin?
I'm one of them, because sometimes families come and they're like, no, I heard, read all this bad research about melatonin. And so my role usually is, okay, I think we should just get a sleep study, or I think we should do some blood work and look for iron deficiency or magnesium deficiency. Those are things we're looking for out the bat. And I could tell you a lot of times, because these kids are also picky eaters, so many times they're low in ferritin. So we're supplementing that. So that's another one.
Yeah.
With melatonin, sometimes what I also would do, especially if you have a child who wakes up very frequently at night, I might do like an extended release melatonin. So not just the regular short acting, because the short acting tends to work with sleep onset. And these are kids where we've already done maybe bedtime fading. We've already done some kind of extension to make sure the child is sleeping independently. If not, that's where I'm starting. Alternatively, in some situations, we may redose. If they say, for instance, I give them melatonin and they fall asleep, and then 2 hours later they're up and it's like a party. Depending on the time that they wake up in the middle of the night, I might redose the melatonin. And now this is something I would not recommend you do alone. Absolutely not. Because most parents just buy that from the counter. This is something you really want to talk with someone, your doctor or something about. We might redose. We might give like a smaller dose, just again to bridge that gap, especially if it's a child who tends to respond to some degree. Sometimes we'll do that. And other times, just the extended release helps with some of those nighttime wakings.
Okay.
And then depending on what's going on, if you have any comorbidity, then the medications we may be using may be related to treating that associated condition. So if you have a child with restless leg syndrome, who maybe you've already supplemented their iron, there are a few medications that we use outside of that that also has some sedating properties, something like gabapentin and a few others we might be able to use. By that time, you are definitely speaking to a sleep physician point. And then in some situations, it could be if they have comorbid anxiety, right? We could use that, because some of these medications that are used to treat these conditions also have a kind of sedating effect. So we leverage that. If they have ADHD, sometimes we'll do guanfacine or clonidine, things like that. So we're working with either your behavioral pediatrician, psychiatrist, neurologist, and things like that to see how do we make the timing work on sleep's behalf, right?
Yeah.
Things absolutely. Like that. Yeah. Because putting it out there, When it comes to medication specific for insomnia, there are no FDA-approved medications for treating insomnia in children. So this is where really we're off-label and we're really using it, thinking of the child holistically. Like, what else could this be benefiting and how do we take advantage of that?
Yeah, that makes sense. Like hydroxyzine is another one that I hear. Mm-hmm. But that also works on the anxiety level of things as
Exactly, pretty much. And I've seen people just use it straight for insomnia. The results are mixed. I would say maybe 50% of kids will do okay. Sometimes if they have like atopy or allergies or things like that, it helps because it's an antihistamine and that antihistamine has a sedating effect. So we'll use that. And those kids I see a bit of benefit if the moms maybe they have like allergies and sometimes that wakes them up or they have eczema and sometimes they get itchy. Oh my goodness, we're running after that. So you're like, what else is going on that we could go after that will also benefit their sleep?
Okay, that's super helpful. So one thing that comes to mind, and I'm seeing a lot of this in my practice, is I get a lot of referrals for kids with the PDA profile, that like pathological demand avoidance, but basically where their nervous system is in fight or flight. And they're edging or they're in that realm of what we call like autistic burnout, right? Like they are just dysregulated all the time. And then sometimes it's that co-regulation is the piece that helps them to be able to fall asleep. I'm thinking, and just to circle back around to our three buckets, we've touched on two of the three. That's one potentially where we're in that third bucket of the 24 hours where we're thinking about regulation as a whole. Any thoughts on that?
No, I think that's one other tool. I'm sure you use this all the time is for some of these kids, they might do well with, again, sensory calming tools. Mm-hmm. So these might be where, as part of their routine, doing like a whole full body massage or using some of those to counterbalance those responses comes in. Sometimes I'll do something like a weighted blanket. Mm-hmm. Those are some things that we can also include as part of their toolbox. And again, I think for many parents, there's this ideal in our minds. But when it comes to having a child with autism, really appreciating how hard it is, I have folks who are like, what has worked for our family is that I lay next to this child and I just hold him extremely tightly and he calms down and he sleeps. And that just works for us. Sometimes that helps them to sleep through the night, just that measure. Sometimes they need to wake up and do it once or twice again at the middle of the night. But we have to meet them where they are to say, okay, what really works for your family? So I don't know if that's something that you also experience.
Yeah. Yeah. All that sensory regulation can be so helpful. But also, are they getting all their sensory needs met throughout the day? Sometimes we see difficulty settling because they actually haven't had enough stimulation. And yeah, I think it becomes so important. Things like what we call heavy work can be really helpful too, where it's lifting things, like obviously not too heavy, but I was just talking about this, stacking cans, for example, like canned goods, or also like pushing things and pulling things. Sometimes that effort gives more of that input that then allows the body to calm down at night. And so I will say on a behavioral side, I will do some strategizing with parents and that's where I'll start. But that was actually one of my questions is like when to see a sleep medicine doctor, like when should families be referred? When should they think about adding someone like you to the team?
Yeah, I would say sooner rather than later. A lot of times, these folks have been struggling for years and years. And at times it's a blood test and we find out, oh, they needed some supplementation or they were nutritionally deficient. So I would say when you have worked thoroughly on, as best as you can, on the routines and you have worked really well on just that, those sensory pieces, and you're still having a child that has a hard time falling asleep, staying asleep, or waking up profoundly early and it's disrupting them, disrupting their day, or even if it's not disrupting them, it's affecting you as the caregiver, that is probably time to, one, bring it up to your pediatrician and lean in and advocate. Let them not tell you the child will outgrow it.
Right.
I think that's really unfair. It's like, when? Tomorrow? Right. Next week? Like, what are we talking about here, right? Really advocate for that, for some intervention. And so in that situation, they may safely be able to say, okay, I think it's time where we should do maybe melatonin. So let's start with that. If you're fortunate and you have a savvy enough pediatrician, they may say, oh, let's just get an iron test and see if there's restless sleep and things like that and see if we could supplement that. But when you start to get to the point where, okay, all of that is not working, you should definitely be reaching out to see a sleep physician. I would say sooner, of course, if you have a child who is snoring or profoundly sleepy during the day, those are signs that they might potentially be an underlying medical sleep disorder. We're not going to wait for that.
Okay. So one thing that I hear actually a lot from families is they know about sleep medicine and their pediatrician is, okay, we're going to just refer you for a sleep study. That's what usually the referral, I think a lot of time is framed as. Yeah. And then I'll hear from parents, there's no way my kid can get through that. So then they don't even contact sleep medicine. Yeah. What would be some of your responses to that when kids can't navigate getting through a sleep study?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's just so common. So I think the first place to start is just lean in with curiosity. Don't make that assumption. I've seen kids who are even nonverbal just fly through a sleep study in the hands of the right, of course, sleep lab and technician and things. So the first thing is also, I would say, first do your research to make sure that they're sending you to a place that has experience with pediatric sleep. I think that's important because a lot of this other places where they hardly see kids, and then you have a child who does have special needs. It's overwhelming, both for the technician, for the child, for the parents, and it's a whole disaster. And then it's a night wasted. So you really want to make sure that's a place that is approved to do pediatric sleep studies, and not every sleep lab is allowed to or is approved to do that, because those folks do this a lot. And if you think about it, a lot of the kids that do get sleep studies, many of them may have some other medical issue, they may have ADHD, they may have autism, or they may have some other syndromes and things like that. So a lot of times these technicians are well-versed in pediatric studies. So that's one I would say to do. The second piece is most times if it's a pediatric sleep lab, they usually will give you information about how to prepare your child for the sleep study. So it becomes this thing that you can work with your OT or your physical therapist to say, okay, they're going to be putting stickers on, they're going to be putting probes on. How do we make this an experience that, you know, your child can get used to or be prepared for? And so sometimes they'll send you maybe a YouTube link so you can see a child that's set up and you guys watch it again and again and again. Sometimes the lab might actually provide mini, like a fake kit where you set it up on the child's teddy bear. So you're just reinforcing that in their minds. And when they show up, they're ready, the parent is ready, and in the hands again of the right tech. It works. You do all that sometimes and it still doesn't work, but at least you want to make sure you give it your best shot. I don't want you to say absolutely not. The issue now is I think what would be brilliant and beautiful would be to be able to do home sleep tests in kids. Because they would be at least within the comfort of their own home. There are less leads and things like that. And we have some work to do, but I think we're getting close to the point where home sleep apnea testing will be approved by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine as a tool for children to start, and then hopefully for children that have sensory needs as well. And then in some situations, if it's not the right time, then it's not the right time. And that's okay too. Especially if it's not like you have a child that has like super strong, intense sleep apnea symptoms, doesn't necessarily have big tonsils or adenoids, which are usually the culprit for sleep apnea. At times you may need to give it a little bit of time and then try again.
And then the other thing I guess I want to add to this is what I'm learning from you today as well. And I knew this, but I think you really hit this home,
is being referred to a sleep medicine physician doesn't mean that the only thing that can be done is a sleep study. There's so many other elements and ways. Mm-hmm. And I think too, we hear all these behavioral recommendations too, mm-hmm. but having someone that truly specializes in this mm-hmm. to help you come up with a curated plan and trial mm-hmm. and error things. And so you don't yeah. just feel like it's a shot in the dark. I feel like that is something I really want to emphasize.
Yes, yes. Thanks for bringing that up. So the way the sleep study works, and I'll just backtrack a bit, your pediatrician can refer you directly to a sleep lab.
Oh.
Which is what I thought you were referring to. Yes, absolutely.
I didn't even realize that.
Okay. They could order a sleep study. So that's, of course, so they order a sleep study, do all that, what I just told you.
Yeah.
If your pediatrician does me the huge favor and sends you to a sleep medicine physician, please come. It is life-changing for these kids because we're looking at this very holistically. One of the things I say is sleep does not just start at night. That's one of the things you talked about. If they've not expended or had an opportunity to really have those stimulating activities during the day, it's going to impact their sleep. So your child's sleep starts from the moment they wake up. So we're looking at their circadian timing. We're looking at what they're eating. We're looking at their behaviors and patterns. And then we start to talk about those three buckets. So there's a whole comprehensive evaluation you get when you come to see a sleep medicine physician. We're not only thinking of sleep apnea, especially if your child is not pausing in breathing during sleep and doing all kinds of wild stuff, but we're still ruling that out. And so in the hands of the right specialist, I could tell you, okay, you know what? Let's focus on the first two bucket or the second and third bucket first. I'm not that concerned about a medical sleep problem. Or then I'm able to say, you know what? I'm going to connect you with a lab that I know will take care of your child's needs because I feel this is absolutely needed. So yes, thanks for bringing that.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if families want to find a sleep physician, like a sleep medicine physician, is there a directory or do you just recommend Googling? How do they go about that?
Yeah. So if you go to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine website, so it's aasm.org. I think it's aasm.org. It's the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. If you Google that,
we'll Google it and put it in the show notes if that sounds good.
There is actually a directory that gives you a list of sleep centers that are all over the country. That would be a good place to start. Sometimes your pediatrician ask your pediatrician, and they may also have someone they work with in your area that can help. So that would be another place to go. A third is if you do have your child's insurance and you could call their phone number to say, I'm looking for a pediatric sleep specialist, they would be able to also provide you with the list. So I think those three places are places that you can go.
Okay. So one last question that comes to mind for me is, and I know this probably could be a whole episode itself, but when there are sleep difficulties, I think a lot of times on social media, we hear about like sleep consultants. And so any recommendations on any thoughts on how to approach that if sleep is coming into play? Obviously, sleep consultants can be helpful on that behavioral piece. But I'll let you talk.
I appreciate you bringing that up. I think we can't, like I said, we're maybe 300 pediatric, certified pediatric sleep medicine physician. There's just not enough of us.
Right.
So the role that sleep consultants play takes a lot of that burden because some of the things they are able to address, maybe that's all the child needs before they eventually make their way to us. So I think there's a role there. But I think it's always just really important that you have a sleep consultant that's very aware of their own sort of their scope.
Yes.
I think it's really important. And I say that even for typically developing kids. If I have a child who has wicked reflux and is back arching and screaming all night long, I don't want you trying to sleep train that child. I want us addressing that reflux or addressing that underlying issue. So the basics, the behavioral piece of it, helping your child get independent sleep and fall asleep through, those things they can absolutely help with. It's when you start to get to the point, either you've worked with them for a while and you're not able to get those goals, then, or if you as a parent are like, I think there's more to this, then I would say it's time to reach out. But they do have a role to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you said, there's those other buckets that are
important to consider which sleep consultants won't have the specialization to be able to address the 24-hour pieces as well as with, especially with co-occurring presentations and then that medical piece in particular. Anything else you want to make sure parents hear before we'll wrap up the episode too with you letting them know where they can connect with you, but anything else sleep-wise or misconceptions that you want to make sure we end this on?
You would just say prioritizing your own sleep. This is where my heart goes. My heart goes out to especially the moms of kids who have children that do have special needs. Like, you are going to be your best self if you are well rested. And so what does that look like? It may look like, of course, learning to delegate, which is like a whole skill that most women have to learn. It may look like asking for help and being vulnerable enough to say, this is where I need help. And it may look like just stepping away for a bit. And so really focusing on those things as well is just so important.
Yeah, no, so important and hard and essential, really.
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely. So if families are listening to this and they want to keep learning from you, where can they connect with you? And then also talk a little bit about your practice and where you're able to actually see families as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This has been such a fun conversation.
It really has.
I hope you've picked enough of my brain.
I know. I could keep going, but we probably do need to wrap up. But this has been jam-packed with information. So it's been awesome.
Yeah. So you can find me on my website. It's restfulsleepmd.com. So that's restfulsleepmd.com. And also I'm on Instagram at Restful Sleep MD. I'm on Facebook as well as Restful Sleep MD. And then I would say the way families work with me, it's threefold. I would say I consult and work with organizations. That's one. The other is that I have my clinical practice. It's the Restful Sleep Place. So if you go to my website, there's a link that takes you to the practice. And I see patients in California, in Pennsylvania, as well as New Jersey. So I see patients by telemedicine, but if you're in Pennsylvania or New Jersey, I could see you in person. But otherwise, it's telemedicine. And finally is through my coaching program. So especially for folks who are not in those three states, my real focus with that is really around coaching moms. But if I have a mom who has a child with autism, then we could talk through strategies where I can help you navigate the system to get your child the support you need, because I do want to make sure that the whole family rests well.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so awesome. Funky, thank you so much for today, this conversation, all of it. I'm really grateful and I'm glad you slid into my DMs too and this episode idea, because it's been well needed for sure.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. This has been a fun conversation and I'm so glad you agreed to having me come on.
Yes. You've been a wealth of knowledge. So thank you so much. All right, y'all. That is a wrap for today's episode of Evolve with Dr. Tay. We will see you back here next time. Before we wrap up this episode, for real this time, I want to share a couple ways you can get even more value and what your next steps could be. First, join the Evolve Facebook group. We do Q&As about the episodes and so much more. I linked that group, my personal social media pages, and any resources I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. So scroll down now and join me online. When you submit questions on any of my pages, your question could be featured on this podcast. How cool is that? I love being able to speak on topics that feel directly relevant to your life. Your questions truly make a difference in the content we create here. One last thing, do your fellow autism parents a favor. Share this episode on your social media and tag me. Autism currently affects 1 in 36 families in the United States and many more worldwide. So I'm sure there is a parent in your social media followers that could be served by this podcast. Thank you again for being here, and I'm so grateful we shared this time together. Bye, y'all.